If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. An unlikely mix of scientist, scholar, engineer, and magician, the Magus sat at the heart of revolutionary thinking in the Renaissance, ushering the dawn of modern chemistry and physics, while also performing feats of magic, utilising secret codes, potions, and a good deal of astrology. Speaking with Emily Briffitt, Anthony Grafton, the author of a new book called Magus, discusses the careers of these men who were seen as geniuses by some and charlatans by others.
Hi, Tony. It's an absolute pleasure to be chatting with you today.
Hi, Emily. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you've recently written the book Magus, The Art of Magic from Faustus to Agrippa, exploring the somewhat strange, the very beguiling figure of the Magus, sat right at the heart of the High Renaissance. So my first question is the obvious one. What exactly is a Magus?
Well, Magus is one of a number of terms for a magician, somebody who has powers, somebody who can work wonders, somebody who can change things in the world, and also somebody who can help people who are suffering from melancholy and other diseases of the mind and body. The term is ancient, and one of the sort of images people would have in mind hearing the term Magus is the three magi who appear with gifts for the baby Jesus and who followed a star, which meant they could be seen as astrologers. One of the things that magi do is astrology. So there was a kind of ancient precedent. It was known that there were magi. The Greek account said this in ancient Persia. So Magus is a classical figure. But he's also a practicing magician, and there were always magicians. There were village magicians, cunning women and cunning men who could help you find lost objects or make you a love potion. But the Magus is an erudite, bookish person, almost always male, and very much seeing himself as part of a learned world. Magi have texts, they make bibliographies, they read, they argue about the meanings of texts. Some of them are great scholars, really very serious scholars in the sense of the Renaissance humanist who reads texts and corrects them. And they appear more and more frequently in the 15th and 16th centuries, though there were medieval magi as well.
Why do they come to such prominence in these centuries in particular?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. One is that there's the rediscovery of the ancient texts associated with Plato's Academy. The academy, which Plato founded, goes on after him for about a millennium. And in the 3rd and 4th centuries of the common era, the Christian era, people in Plato's academy were very interested in things that we associate with magic. They were interested in speaking to planetary spirits. They were interested in all sorts of forms of understanding, but also controlling the universe. And when these texts were rediscovered, as they were in the 15th century by people like one of my characters, Marsilio Ficino, a really serious great Greek scholar, that made a big impression. One important text was a group of dialogues ascribed to an Egyptian sage called Hermes Trismegistus, thrice greatest Hermes. They were actually written in Egypt, but by Greek people whose culture was Greek and who were trying to imagine an Egyptian culture. But those seem to give a really powerful ancient precedent for the Magi. So they're figures who are looking backward. Faustus, the real Magus with whom I begin, who's a shady character, but definitely a practicing magician, famously brings back ancient beings. He brings back the warriors from the Trojan War. He brings back Helen. And that's a kind of classical magic. It's humanistic magic in which he's bringing back antiquity. He even offered to bring back lost plays by Roman writers, which really frightened his audience at university because, you know, who knew what he might put into them. So magic, it's a classical discipline, but it's also an Islamic discipline. There's a huge amount of the material that comes to the Latin world in the 12th and 13th centuries of astrology and magic and alchemy play a huge part in Islamic culture. And so those texts come as well. And so there's a gigantic magical library, and that helps to give them authority. And that really is part of the magician's image. When Prospero drowns his staff and gets rid of his books, that's it. He can't practice magic anymore. And in that, Shakespeare is very well informed.
So you mentioned the alchemy and astrology. These have been seem to be really commonly connected to the figure of the Magus. Why is this?
Well, alchemy, and I try to show in this book that alchemy is actually a different tradition, but most of the Magi are interested in alchemy, and a couple of them write influential treatments of it. Alchemy actually works in a physical sense. It's one of the great discoveries of historians of science in the last couple of generations. Larry Principe and Bill Newman and my colleague Jenny Rampling and others have recreated alchemical procedures. And it turns out that alchemy is metallic crystalline chemistry, and it works quite well if you can just understand the recipes. And so that is an independent tradition, which also goes back to antiquity, but it keeps intersecting with the magical tradition. But the big difference is it works, which is one reason why Newton and Boyle and Hooke are still really interested in alchemy at a point when they've really given up on astrology and many of the other characteristic pursuits of the Magus. Astrology is the great predictive art of the pre-modern world. It still, of course, flourishes. Supposedly, polls show that more Americans believe in astrology than in any version of Christianity. But I don't think that's a very strong kind of belief. But the thing about astrology is you take the angles at which the planets and the stars are looking at the place on Earth where someone is born at the moment when that person is born. And they're sending down rays which are going to have a big impact on that person's body, character, mind, fortune. And the idea is that if you do a really elaborate horoscope, which can be hundreds of pages long, very expensive, you can really get a sense of what that person's going to do and what they're going to experience and what skills they have and what you need to do to educate them. You can also do this for states. You can do this for economic enterprises. The historical Nostradamus guided a mining entrepreneur and told him, you know, go left, go right. And the thing I like to compare, the discipline I like to compare it with in the modern world is economics. because astrology tries to make the world predictable. And it does that by making it quantitative, by reducing it to a precise set of quantitative models. And the astronomy that's behind it is quite good astronomy, so they can do that. And it really is a wonderful way of giving people assurance that we have some idea of what's going to happen, which I think is one of the things that economists do. And, you know, in each case, they always get big things wrong. And they always end up with better jobs and bigger salaries. So, you know, that's another part of these predictive traditions.
What other fields of study were also of interest to the Magus?
Well, they're very interested in recipes of all sorts. They're interested in strange materials that might be usable for medicinal or other purposes. They're interested in very modest recipes. You know, you have a sore throat, you put a toad in your mouth. I mean, that sort of thing, which are attested in Greek and Roman texts, but would also be part of the popular magic that a cunning woman might practice. The core of this magic, they're interested in drawing down the power of the heavens and making it work on earth. So it's not just prediction, but it's actually communicating somehow with the planets and drawing the favor of the ones that are good for you and averting the disfavor of ones like Saturn, which tend to be problematic. A lot of magic has to do with making talismans that make you stronger. A lot of magic has to do with rituals that you carry out, which are worryingly like religious or parodic satanic rituals in the eyes of many authorities. So ritual magic is very important. And finally, magic gets very close to mysticism, in that the magician is in contact with higher beings, and so is the mystic in this period, the person who has direct communion with God through a whole series of complicated exercises. So Johannes Trithemius, we call him in English, a great German Benedictine and magus, is one of my characters, and he's really very interested in both things, and it's not clear that he distinguishes them very sharply. So he has treatises about how you reach union with God, which involve using particular kinds of materials and carrying out particular rituals. And he has a lot to say about secret communication and other magical things. Two more things are very period connected. One is the Kabbalah, the Jewish Kabbalah, this vast and wonderful body of biblical exegesis and contemplative mysticism and magic, which are all kind of connected in a big, loose, wonderfully creative world. Christians don't really get this in a very deep way, but they do begin to learn about it in the 15th and 16th centuries. Pico della Mirandola is another of my characters, actually has a very learned Jewish teacher and another very learned teacher, a one-time Jew who had become a Christian, who actually translates hundreds of pages of Kabbalistic commentaries for him. And Pico actually masters some of this. So this is a new discovery for Christians, the Kabbalah. They've never really had access to this material, and they're fascinated by it. And even at times when Christians are most oppressive to Jews in this period, as they often are, they sometimes see the Kabbalah as a valid and valuable form of learning. And the other real period thing is ciphers. This is the first great age of diplomacy. And all of a sudden, every state and every important prelate has representatives at court and representatives at other courts, and you need to communicate with them. Of course, there was a famous American official, Henry Stimson, who said, "Gentlemen, don't read each other's mail." But of course, that's the first thing you want to do when somebody's at your court, is stop his courier, open the mail, and read it. So there is a tradition of ciphers which become much more elaborate and sophisticated in the 15th and 16th centuries. And that's what makes Trithemius famous, is that he has a cipher manual and a steganography manual, a manual for concealing the fact that you're sending messages at all. The ciphers actually work, by the way. So all of these are the bundle of things which magi do, and you can see why they have a lot of services they can offer. One way to think of them is as service providers for people of wealth and culture.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block. Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Canva.
What was their goal or ambition in their study? Was it purely to help people, or was there an element of self-interest and thriving and thirst for learning?
Oh, there's an immense self-interest. These are people who are tremendously concerned with the reception of their ideas. They're great at hunting up publicity in different ways. Ficino did the first translation into Latin of the complete works of Plato. Great work of scholarship and tremendously important. And he waited to publish it until 1484, when Jupiter and Saturn were in conjunction, because that would be favorable. Pico della Mirandola wanted to invite, he did invite the scholars from all over Europe to a disputation with him about all forms of knowledge. It was never held, but again, a great publicity thing. And Agrippa, on the title page of his great manual, The On Occult Philosophy, is a portrait of him. And, you know, so the whole book, in a way, advertises his learning and brilliance and connections with important people. So, yes, they're certainly, as we academics are now, you know, they're out to be famous and they're out to sell books because you don't get royalties, but it makes it easier to persuade publishers to reprint them and do new editions. And they're out for pensions and other gifts at courts. And all of those things are possibilities. But Agrippa, who for me is sort of the consummate magus, is also an engineer. And so what's fascinating to me in him is that you see all the ambitions of the Renaissance magus. There's the therapeutic ambition to be able to heal people who are sick, and particularly people who are suffering from what we would call mental illnesses. But there's also the practical ambition. And I think finally, just this explosive encyclopedic ambition, crossing borders, moving across fields, insisting that you can master all of this. This is very much part of this world of the High Renaissance in which they fall, and remains even when the magic begins to look old-fashioned and problematic. Both René Descartes and Francis Bacon, who are two of the people who begin to drive magic from the world of learning, are still encyclopedists in this way and still have the same kind of hope that they can reconfigure the whole of learning. And I think that the Magi help to create that ambition and to make it seem possible.
So who actually sees the opportunity to pursue the study of magic?
Things that we associate with the magus, because different ones put their emphasis in different places. But you find Ficino is a great medical man and scholar. Pico, who is actually a prince who sells his birthright to have money to buy books and becomes a great scholar. Agrippa, who is really an engineer who consults with people about weapons and mills and other things, which is part of the engineering tradition that gets going in the later Middle Ages and Renaissance. Tritemius is a Benedictine. He's the head of two different Benedictine cloisters, but he's really chased out of the first one because he's doing things that worry his colleagues. And so they're men of a certain social position. They're usually quite well educated. So even Faustus, who has often been seen as the bad penny, the unrespectable part of the magical tradition, was university educated at Heidelberg and was not a bad student. And he's not a good magus. He fakes his horoscopes and he makes all sorts of claims that even other people interested in magic think are ridiculous. But, you know, he recognizably is part of the same world as they are. And that means that he combines astrology, conjuring, and these tricks that come from the engineering tradition. He seems to have held the first slide lecture in a German university with a projecting device that projected images of these ancient heroes. It would have been on a curtain, and he presumably had a confederate who knew how to move the curtain to make the figures look alive. Good Renaissance theatrical technology.
In that way, how could the discerning observer spot a charlatan from the genuine article?
Really good question. There's a wonderful scholar at Brown University, Tara Neumittel, who has actually studied a female charlatan in a wonderful book. She was a charlatan, sort of alchemist and transmuter of metals. And alchemy certainly had its share of charlatans, because they couldn't actually produce gold and they couldn't actually help your coinage. And so that's an area where there is a certain amount of fakery. But we, I think, have this idea that it would be easy to detect a charlatan. But I did some work with a magician, an actual conjurer, and it's clear that some of this involved very sophisticated techniques. Agrippa describes a method for basically projecting a message onto the moon so that it's visible at a great distance. And there's a copy of his book in the great library in Wolfenbüttel in Germany, which belonged to another Benedictine. And in the margin there, he's written, yeah, I saw this done in 1546. So my conjurer friend said, well, imagine you're in an early modern village at night, which of course is infinitely darker than anything we can imagine. I always try to think of it in terms of West Africa. My daughter was there in the Peace Corps, and you know, her village at night was just incredibly dark, and a full moon was incredibly big and bright. And you have this projecting thing, and you would probably project in red, because red is a kind of very interesting color that disappears. And you say, see, and now look up! And, you know, people would look up and there would be vestiges of what they'd seen on the face of this enormous face of the moon. So I think the other thing I think we have to understand is it's a very theatrical world, and people have a lot of will for suspension of disbelief. And that's part of the way the Catholic Church works. You know, there are many, many convents you can go to where the rood is a statue which will move and will move its head and move its arms. And the people going are very sophisticated, you know, 15th, 16th century people. But in that place, they're willing to suspend disbelief and see something miraculous happen. And I think that that also works for a skilled magus and performer with charisma, that, you know, people suspend disbelief and they'll go along with what you're doing. And I'm afraid we still do this too. I mean, to anybody who has lived through the rise and fall of Elizabeth Holmes and Sam Bankman-Fried, it's impossible not to see that a bit of charisma and a good line of patter can get you a long way even now.
So what did the practice of magic look like to those actually practicing it? And how is it different to what we might expect of magic today?
It's much more erudite. It involves real knowledge of many languages. It's not quaint. The book would look like other books, and there were lots of books that were about symbols and forms and hieroglyphs. So a magic book having symbols in it didn't make it particularly different from other forms of book. And it would involve usually a kind of ascetic preparation, but so did many forms of prayer and contemplation in the church. And it would involve performing a ritual. And The final thing, which I think is really important, is this is a hierarchical world. So in the 16th century, in the 15th century, if you want something from a ruler, you don't go to the ruler. You go to the noble that you know, who may know another higher noble who knows the ruler. And so you really approach the universe in the same way, through a hierarchy, and you work through lower powers to higher powers. And all of that, I think, really makes sense, though all of that is also one of the things that makes something like Agrippa look dangerous, because a sophisticated cleric reading it, well, some think, wow, this is great, but others think this is a sort of pagan parody of Christianity. This is paganism coming back after centuries in which we had managed to extirpate it, and so it's dangerous and scary.
Why else did the Magus attract such hostile criticism?
Well, I think the courtly environment is basically a tightrope over a piranha pool. It's an environment in which everyone is seeking favor, and favor is something that is always precarious. And if you're a monarch or a great prelate, you have to withdraw favor some of the time in order to keep people up to the mark. And, you know, there's a wonderful scene in Hilary Mantel, I think it's in Wolf Hall, where Wolsey says when he loses favor that it's like having a stone in the heart. It's an existential disaster. And so one of the reasons you want to discredit the Magus is that you want to be the one who's whispering into the... And there are lots of rivals. There is, for example, the Machiavel, including Machiavelli himself, who wanted this sort of job. The secretary who stands at the duke's ear, the king's ear, and whispers very pragmatic, very precise, very, we might say, realistic advice. And that's somebody who is a rival for precedence and for patronage and for telling you how to master the universe.
This is something that seems to be sort of running through the story of the Magus. This intersection between magic and religion and science and the secular. Could you tell us a little bit about this and how we can see it through the story of the Magus?
Yeah, it's a world in which is full of things that are charged with power. So every great church has these magnificent relics of ancient and medieval and recent saints. And so when you go to a church, particularly for an important feast, you'll have a bucket list of the relics that you want to see. And we have testimony from very learned people of just what a powerful experience it was to be in the presence of the skull of Mary Magdalene, which is in Provence, or the skull of John the Baptist, which is in Amiens, sort of floating in a reliquary, and you actually see the face through a crystal. So in one sense, it's a world in which things that are charged with power, that are connected to powerful supernatural beings, are actually part of the common sense of everyday life. And so the idea that there might be others which are natural rather than supernatural is not that far away. And the idea really is that natural things may have particular powers that we don't know about. Plants may have them, stones may have them, and so on. And that, you know, in the same way that you wouldn't necessarily know that a relic had power until someone has a vision and you go and you find the relic and then you move it. And once you move it, it starts doing miracles. So that interaction seems to me, of course, in some ways, the magical object seems to raise questions about the relic. But I think in other ways, it just looks like part of the same kind of universe. For me, the interaction that I really didn't expect to find to the extent I did is the one between technology and magic. So from the 14th century on, and it's a great historian, Pamela Long, has written wonderfully about this, you begin to see people who are called engineers, it doesn't quite mean what we mean, or architects, or just artisans, who are doing extraordinary things and beginning to occupy a position of more and more power and authority in society. And again, beginning to write about what they do, beginning to write illustrated books that show what they can do. So someone like Filippo Brunelleschi in Florence, who puts the dome on the Florentine Cathedral, the committee of great men who were charged with overseeing the dome thought he was insane. I mean, they literally had him carried out of their meetings twice by their servants because he was proposing to close the dome without building a scaffold under it. And of course, he did that when they finally allowed him to do it. So technology is really exciting. This is the age in which gunpowder transforms warfare. It's the age in which navigation is certainly much more sophisticated than it had been, though it's really later that you get the ability to know what longitude you're at. And it's the age in which printing comes in, and especially for learned print people, that's really almost miraculous. So it's an age in which there are real technologies coming in, usually from Asia, and being adapted to new purposes in the Latin West. And the thing about the Latin West, the fashionable thing to say now, which is quite true, is that the Central European tradition is one of stealing ideas and technologies from everywhere else. And that's perfectly true. But the thing of it is, Europeans were really good at doing this. So paper comes to Latin Europe from the Islamic world. And by the early 15th century, Islamic religious authorities are telling their fellow religionists that it's all right to use paper with a Christian watermark, because the Christians are producing so much paper that they're selling it back to the Muslims. And magic is in a way part of that. And it too derives techniques from the East. It too has that prestige. But the thing is, magicians are also really interested in technology, and technologists claim some of the rhetoric or some of the brilliance in performance of magic. So there's a lot of interaction between the two. And it's really in Agrippa that you see this coming to a kind of synthesis, where for him, it's all really magic. Technology is magic, and therapy is magic, and astrology is magic, and cryptography is magic. And that's the view that you'll see in someone like John Dee, who is both a brilliant and a problematic figure. He's one of the inheritors of this tradition. There are many of them in the mid and late 16th and 17th centuries.
It's such a truly extraordinary time of change. So I'd just like to ask you, what did the Magus themselves contribute to this revolutionizing of society?
Well, I think they contributed something which is now looks quite problematic, which is this notion that humanity is the master over nature. And that I think they really play a part in making that a popular view. And, you know, now we can very easily see the downside of that view. But it really became very popular, I mean, to the extent that New World settlers really thought that they were transforming the colonies. They were transforming nature, that as they cut down the forests and made arable land, they were actually going to change the climate so it was more favorable for farming. That vast invasion of a new continent, as they thought it, and of course the inhabitants didn't see it that way, is in part a response to this notion that we have tools that will enable us to transform the world. So I don't see this as really a great idea, but it was certainly a powerful idea, and the Magi gave it expression and seemed to give it substance. The other thing that I think they helped to spread is this wonderful vision of the universe as a vast, harmonious kind of mechanism, all parts of which are connected by radiation or physically or by shape, so that a shell which is shaped like a bodily organ might have a beneficent effect on that organ. None of that is new, but it becomes so complete and coherent and powerful in the both in the writings and in the practices of the magicians, I think. And that's, again, a kind of idea which it's extraordinarily productive for artists and writers. You see in Shakespeare I think it's Lorenzo is telling Jessica to look up and hear the cherubim singing and see this wonderful hierarchy of the universe in Merchant of Venice. I mean, Shakespeare evokes this harmonious universe again and again. And finally, I think there's just this vision of the human intellect as kind of powerful and tormented, which is something that you don't need to go to Goethe's Faust to see. I mean, one kind of writing about Faust is very much pamphlet writing, sort of almost comic writing about this charlatan. But Marlowe's Dr. Faustus really already shows you what the thinking about magic can make you think, and in which the devil who works with Faustus, after all, is one of these great Elizabethan Jacobean figures who are simultaneously evil and in some way attractive, so that we can almost feel sympathy with him. The sort of magnificent ability to sympathize with people whose aspirations are just too great and who can't resist that temptation. That's something which comes with the magical tradition.
There are so many standout characters in your book. Is there perhaps one that intrigues you most, or one that you are most fascinated by?
I think the one I'm most fascinated by in the end is Tritemius, this Benedictine who is the most extraordinary character. He invents historical texts about the movements of the ancient Germans. He cleans up monasteries. He writes a book about how bad printing is. You know, printed books aren't going to last, which he writes for a printer and has printed in a special handsome typeface. He is clearly, in one way, a deep believer in the whole miraculous culture of the late medieval church. And yet he does these wonderful works on cryptography and steganography. In the cryptography, you learn how to write things that look like prayers, but are actually secret messages. And the whole idea of using prayer for a secret message is really very troubling. And in his steganography, basically, it's all about getting demonic figures to summon your girlfriend at the right time. And again, none of this is real, including in consulting demonic figures. It's steganography designed to conceal that there's a real message being sent. But this is just a complex and interesting person. I think a real mystic, I think a real believer in the powers of magic, but also in part a clear charlatan. He even dies at just the right time because the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian is sending him messengers saying, could we just see these texts you quote about the history of the Germans?
What do you think listeners should take away from the stories of the Magus? There's so much interesting stuff here. What do you think they should go with?
I think really two things. One of which is that magic is a really powerful tradition, independent of its validity. It's a powerful tradition. Brilliant people who are highly rationalist in other parts of their lives have believed in it, practiced it, and furthered it. And the best way to understand that is to realize that there may be traditions like that even now, which we see as part of our rationality, but which won't look that way in the future. The other thing I just find in it is a fascination with this early moment in which technology was making promises, and the promises of a vast transformation of the world. And because that really, I think, does go into the 17th and 18th century. There's a recent book which talks about what they call cornucopianism, the idea that technology and science can work with the world to produce everything we need to make life better and to support bigger populations. And they associate this with Francis Bacon, but also earlier back with Thomas More and his Utopia. But I think I also associate this with the magical tradition. The magical tradition is encyclopedic and it's just swarming with promises. And I do think that this cornucopianism, which becomes part of the 17th century projectors that Ben Jonson made fun of, but also which we still see, cornucopianism is still for me, part of the pitch that you make when you're saying, I can give you blood tests for nothing at home, or I can give you crypto, which is absolutely safe. You know, there's always a kind of cornucopianism. And I do feel as if that's a kind of powerful part of modernity, early and late modernity, that the magicians play a big part in crafting.
I think that's an absolutely fantastic point to leave us on. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Tony.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
That was Anthony Grafton, Professor of History at Princeton University. His book, Magus, The Art of Magic from Faustus to Agrippa, is out now, published by Alan Lane. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.